Well, Jared, in your book, you argue that the rise of digital networks, you know, like Facebook and Google, has led our economy into recession and decimated the middle class, which most of us who use Facebook and Google probably think, how can that be? What kind of financial implications could using Facebook have?
Yes. Well, here's the issue. The issue is that we've adopted a business model for using information technology where by far the best way to make money is to have the biggest computer on the network in some remote server farm that builds behavioral models of other people and then uses those behavioral models to subtly manipulate those people. And the problem with that business model is that it works so well that it concentrates wealth and power in an incredibly exclusive club of the people who own the biggest computer.
Wow, you're describing now, 1984.
Well, you know, it's not exactly 1984 because 1984 was all gray and drab. And in truth, most of the people who own the biggest computers are kind of young and hip and cool and nice. And they really are. I mean, we have the sweetest elite in history, probably. But, you know, it doesn't matter. The point is that we're concentrating wealth and power so intensely that it's undoing our security and our futures. And I have to point out that the architecture has had its worst effects so far, not in things like social media and search and whatnot, but in finance. But the thing is, if you look at the big hedge funds and high-frequency trading firms and all these concerns, it's the same type of computer, the same algorithms, the same architectures, the same kinds of people, the same kinds of strategy. You know, if you just change the labels, we're looking at the same thing. It's just a way of using information to concentrate power. And so the way it happens is that initially you get some incredibly sweet candy that incites you to enter into the system and give over information to other people. And in finance, it might be a too good to believe mortgage or something like that, recently maybe bitcoins. But anyway, whatever it is, it's some kind of candy. And then in the case of consumer internet stuff, it's like free services, free social networking or whatever. And then what happens is you start giving over your information to these parties who use it to calculate wealth out of the world. And they are so good at it that they actually undermine the world in which their wealth even makes sense. And that's called too big to fail.
Well, play this out in more consumer-oriented terms. I mean, there is, for instance, you point out this sort of astonishing discrepancy between when we used to have big companies like Kodak versus little tiny companies that may be worth more but are, you know, have tiny numbers of employees.
Right. So what's happened now is that we've taken what used to be really huge industries in terms of middle class jobs like music and photography and this thing you might have heard of called journalism. And
never heard of that.
And what's happened is we've replaced an old system in which there were many hundreds of thousands of solid middle class jobs with security and the potential for retirement and a safety cushion and all of those good things. And we've replaced them with a system in which there's early treats. There's a really easier on-ramp in this illusion of sort of equity and access for everybody. Well, it's more than an illusion. The early treats can sometimes be very real. But the problem with it is that there's only a token number of success stories, a tiny token number of people who have successful YouTube videos or something like that. And everyone else lives on hope. It's a revival of the old Horatio Alger stories from the 19th century. And this economy of most people sort of scrambling for hope with a tiny number of token winners of sort of princes or, you know, the very special unusual people instead of a real middle class is no way to run a civilization. You know, you can't have a democracy that way. You need a democracy totally relies on people broadly being able to outspend the tip of elites, you know, and we lose that in that world. And it's only starting. I mean, the really big thing happens when the cars are driving themselves and robots are operating the factories or objects are being printed out for us by 3D printers. As the century progresses in a couple decades from now, perhaps, we're going to start to lose a lot of middle-class jobs. And the thing about that is that all that stuff still runs on information. Somebody's going to design the objects that are printed out by 3D printers. But, you know, if we keep on doing things the way we are, all the money's going to accrue to whatever big computer is routing the information and only tiny token number of people will, you know, actually benefit from the system themselves and everyone else will live on hope. And that leads us to nowhere. It leads us to a failed economy.
Mm. So for instance, people are all excited right now talking about the Khan Academy or MOOCs or other ways of taking higher education online. Are you, for instance, suggesting that if we follow down that path much further, you know, in the next generation, you aren't going to be able to have a job as a professor at a university?
Yeah, I mean, it really hit me hard one day when during the Arab Spring, when I was watching these incredible bright young kids in Tahrir Square, and I was thinking, you know, what a wonderful thing that we're giving them some options to have a voice and to get an education. And there's no denying how great that is. But on the other hand, we're also taking away their hope to become professors themselves. We're taking away the money that might be within Egyptian society, say, to create better Egyptian universities in a broader academic class in Egypt, and instead concentrating it in our computers that typically are in California.
Are there any safe careers? I mean, okay, so maybe better not to become a taxi driver or go into higher education. What about, you know, old-fashioned things like being a doctor? I mean, you can't create a robot that does the surgery.
Well, nobody knows exactly what can be automated. You know, the history of the fear of losing jobs to automation goes way, way back. It goes to the 19th century. Marxism started off precisely because of people being afraid that machines would take their jobs, and the Luddite riots and many other examples in the 19th century. By the way, that anxiety is where science fiction comes from, too. One of the great themes of science fiction from the very beginning was people becoming obsolete because of our own technology. Mm-hmm. It continues to be so. That's the Matrix and the Terminator movies and all that. But the thing about doctors and other sort of white-collar professional jobs is that recently there have been really excellent demonstrations of people using crowdsourced algorithms to simulate a lot of what doctors and nurses and pharmacists and lawyers and all kinds of other people do. And it's hard to know exactly when something like that would work. But the key thing I want people to realize is that whenever you have a computer that seems to do a person's job, it's a fake. It's just theater. For instance, when you upload some text in one language and it's translated to a different language by an online service, by Google or Microsoft, what's actually going on is a bunch of real examples of translations from real people are being collaged together using pattern matching to create a mashup that's an approximate translation. And it works pretty well. But the thing is, it's sourced from the work of real people who are deliberately forgotten in order to create the illusion of a machine intelligence. So we really should stop thinking about machine intelligence, and we should only think about accounting fraud, because that's all that's there.
Is there a certain amount of mea culpa here for you? I mean, as a technology pioneer, you helped advocate for and create the system we're talking about.
Yeah, totally. And I don't shy away from that. And in fact, the mea culpa goes beyond my past to my present. I mean, I'm absolutely living, you know, within a sort of a compromised position, because I don't want to become some sort of perfect soul who's just a critic from afar. I love doing technology. I actually love Silicon Valley. I love making products. I love working with the big companies and with little startups. I love the whole thing. I just think we should try to start being honest about what we're doing to try to change it. And so I don't want to renounce everything about my life to try to improve it. So absolutely mea culpa. In the early days, which is 30 years ago, it really did seem like making information free would do the most for the most people. You know, it's logical. If you think about it, you'd think it would be right. And what we got wrong, the big mistake, is, you know, even though people are created equal, computers aren't. If you have a bunch of people sharing information, but some people have much bigger and better computers, they'll be able to use exactly the same information to compute much, much more power and wealth for themselves. And that effect undoes, you know, what was really a well-intended idea.
Yeah, it was a dream. I mean, it's such an irony that the dream of, you know, living in a giant creative commons in which information would finally be free from proprietary evil corporate ownership. And that was a great dream, but it sounds like it didn't work out.
It sounds so good. It's one of those perfect ideas, kind of like perfect libertarianism or perfect socialism or something like that. It sounds good on first pass, and I totally think it was worth a try. And I don't even regret trying it. You know, it's just the thing is, like, you have to look at empirical results. And sometimes these perfect ideas, I mean, look at the first decade of this century. usually when you have some new technology show up that makes everything more efficient, it should benefit people. I mean, that's what happened with, I don't know, interstate roads or plumbing or electricity in the wall or vaccinations or zillions of other things. And with the internet, you know, it's appeared and it's created all this efficiency, and yet there's been endless recession and jobless recoveries and austerity. And you have to ask, what happened? You know, and so we can't just living on the fumes of, we can't go on living on the fumes of ideology. We have to accept the empirical results, which is that we have not made the world better in the way we expected to.
Well, it sounds like the underlying issue is that we've created a world in which humans seem to be becoming less and less useful. You know, machines are increasingly better at creating value than people are, and yet, what you're pointing out is that that's an illusion. Of course they're not. We've just created this kind of giant shell game in which we're not valuing the human part of the input.
Exactly. That's precisely what's going on. We're creating a theatrical illusion in which we're pretending that value isn't coming from people in order to support the fantasy of artificial intelligence on a network doing work, which is not real at all. But so, what it does do is it concentrates huge fortunes with the people who own this illusion.
Right. Well, you've proposed that we, as part of beginning to craft a solution, something you call a humanistic information economy. What is that?
Well, this goes back to the very origin of the whole idea of connecting people on a digital network. And what's interesting is that the very first generation of ideas were exactly what I'm proposing. So I'm not really proposing something radically new, but in a way going back to where we started. So back in 1960, the first ideas about how to connect people on digital networks were articulated, and the fellow who did it was named Ted Nelson. He's actually still with us, and he's still named Ted Nelson. And Ted's idea is simple. His parents were Hollywood parents, and he'd seen directly how the labor movement had created a possibility for actors and musicians in Hollywood to find some sense of security, even in a business that was very kind of chancy and where you lived gig to gig. And he realized that someday, as automation got really good and machines got better and better, we'd move into an information economy and everybody would be living a life that's kind of like what a Hollywood actor or musician was living, and everybody would need the same kinds of benefits. Everybody who's a truck driver now or a miner or a teacher or a doctor or a nurse or anybody at all was going to be in the same boat. And he saw that there was a kind of simple solution, actually. And the solution is to always keep track of where information comes from on a network. And if you have a link back to whoever was the source of information that's useful later, you can send them a micropayment. And if you have a universal micropayment system in a richly, densely connected network, you would naturally create a middle class out of an information economy that would be persistent. And then you could afford to have a democracy because the middle class could always outspend the elite and so forth. So it would create a solution that would finally get us beyond the fear of automation killing jobs.
Well, does this mean that, I don't know, to open a link a friend puts on Facebook, I'd have to pay her?
Well, right. And the key thing to remember is that you're also getting paid. I mean, the whole thing about capitalism is that you have to kind of go on faith that even though you have to pay for stuff, you're also getting paid for your stuff. And by having economic activity, the overall value of the society is going up. So on average, people are doing better than they otherwise would.
That's so the goal would be to post more stuff than you read.
Well, no, not exactly. Here's the way I see it working out. The world is currently working now is all of us are being scrutinized constantly by algorithms and remote big computers. They're behavioral models of all of us, and third parties are paying to use those models to manipulate us. They manipulate what links you see on Google and who you're introduced to on Facebook and all kinds of stuff like that. And the idea is to sort of gradually create this perfect investment where you can just pay to manipulate the world to your benefit. Now, the thing is that all of that value that we're providing is very real. So if we just kept track of whenever there are bits that exist because of you, even if you didn't intend to create them, and that would create a micropayment, you'd constantly be earning little dribs and drabs of money. It's not necessarily a conscious thing.
Whoa, do you mean that if I'm like browsing the new books at Amazon, and of course Amazon keeps track of what books I look at, later I'm going to get a little check in the mail from Amazon?
if and only if that data contributes to Amazon being able to increase its profits by using that data in some way. Yeah, absolutely. And I know this might sound like sort of an alien or weird scheme to people, but the thing you have to understand is that the complexity of it is actually less than what we're doing now. People don't understand how insane what we're doing now is. And the sort of the notion that keeping track of where value comes from will actually lead to betterment for people is just the same old weird trick of capitalism, which does actually work. So it's just a combination of using network design and capitalism together more efficiently than what we're currently doing. And I know it sounds sort of alien and weird, but it actually does make sense. I mean, in a funny way, it's exactly what's implemented within the confines of somebody's private networking space. Like when you go on Facebook, you can keep track of who's linked to you. It's a full network. If Facebook was monetized, it would actually generate a ton of money, and that would actually be good for people and good for Facebook. It would actually make Facebook a richer company. So this is not.
Have you mentioned this to Mark Zuckerberg? Never mind. He has enough money.
I'd rather not talk about my direct interactions with people in Silicon Valley, but I'm getting more traction with this stuff than I expected. Actually, I mean, people are open-minded. It's technically sound, so people are open to listening to it. Now, there's certainly a lot of arguments, and particularly about the details, which I'm not so presumptuous to think that I can work out all the details in advance.
But so play this out a bit, because I want to make sure I understand it. So how would this work in practice? I don't know, I'm going online and I'm using, Pinterest or Facebook, or I'm ordering some music on iTunes. What would change?
Well, what would change is if you're on Pinterest and, first of all, if you get a lot of attention in Pinterest, you get direct money from that. But more importantly, if some fund somewhere is analyzing what you do on Pinterest and they realize that they should change their investment in real estate in your neighborhood based on behavioral models of people in your neighborhood, based on how people in your neighborhood are looking at your Pinterest information. The way this happens is all very indirect and very weird and algorithmic and doesn't necessarily even make sense to the human mind. But whatever it is, there'd be links back to where the information came from. And if the result of an algorithm created a profit, there would be a backscattering of micropayments to all the sources of the information. Let me give you another example of how this would work. Right now, major cities are just festooned with spy cameras that keep track of everybody for security, and we benefit from these, as we saw in Boston recently. And pretty soon, people will be wearing cameras on their heads all the time, possibly. So we're in this world of cameras, and what that means is that there are multiple remote computers run by super rich interests who can track where you go all the time, or will be able to soon. And this is kind of creepy. This is the kind of surveillance that people died in wars to avoid in authoritarian regimes. And we're sort of imagining that only nice people will ever own the big computers, which is a pretty bad bet to make, even if they're nice at the moment. So in this regime where it costs money to do things with bits, if you're recognized by one of these algorithms, you actually get a micropayment, because those are bits that wouldn't exist without you. And so the use of the tracking of people would be tempered, because it would cost money. Information wouldn't be free anymore. So it's actually a way to preserve rights, because using laws to prohibit uses of information systems is incredibly hard, but sicking accountants and lawyers on people to get money that's due actually works. And so I think when people look at the whole system, they'll see that while it would be frustrating and imperfect in a whole lot of ways, in the ways that human societies always are frustrating and imperfect, at least it gives us a way to get out from under this quality of total surveillance without any tempering effect.
Can you really see this happening without revolution in the streets or laws imposed? I mean, corporations are not just going to be really happy to start handing back micropayments to millions of people.
Well, I put the question exactly in reverse. I see this as a way of avoiding revolution in the streets, because what I'm worried about is money and power being so concentrated, not immediately, but maybe in like 20 or 30 years, if this pattern persists, that there'll be massive unemployment and massive concentrations of wealth. And then there will be a revolution of just the kind that is extremely unpleasant. And I very much want to avoid that. So I actually think what I'm saying is good for ordinary people, but it's also good for corporations. I mean, the thing about corporations and finance schemes and any activity in capitalism is that it's only valuable to the degree an overall society is wealthy and an economy is growing, in fact, and that, you know, they all feed off of general well-being. And if we're undoing that, we're actually undercutting these very institutions that you know, are propagating it. And I think ultimately they'll see that it's in their own self-interest.
One of the things I think is so fascinating about what you do is you seem to come up with these solutions that are extremely practical, very specific, very technical, but they represent these gigantic paradigm shifts. So they sort of like they're like icebergs, you know, they're small on the top and then huge underneath. I mean, I was thinking there's another one, like you talk about value, how we calculate value, and you've got I'm not sure I understand it, but you've got some suggestions for reforming the way we set prices.
Well, look, you know, in terms of ambition, I know it can sound a little crazy now, but that's a sort of an illusion because we're sort of so used to the way the internet has come about that the conservative thing now, or the easy thing, is just to imagine it would always be this way. But the internet was just a weird thing to start with. I mean, I've gone through this cycle a few times already. It's pretty routine in Silicon Valley to see somebody with a crazy idea in a garage sort of pull the whole world into that idea in a few years. I mean, Facebook is a good example. That just happened pretty quickly, and that's pretty recent. And the internet design is something that was made by people specifically, and it spread really quickly. And it's, yeah, sure, it's entrenched, but there can be more phenomena like that. I don't think what I'm doing now is more ambitious than any of the ideas I've been part of in the past. In fact, it's probably less so. It's a little bit more tempered and less nutty, I think, than the sorts of ideas that led to where we are now.
Yeah, it's interesting. We tend not to think of our world as iterative, you know, but as you just pointed out, of course it is. I mean, we take for granted that the online mediation that we live with, Facebook and Google and all of it, is just the way it's always been. But yeah, good point.
Well, one thing that really bugs me is that there's a sort of an official or almost like dictated melodrama that everybody's supposed to buy into now. And the melodrama is that there's this new wave of better ideas, which are like social media and open culture and open this and that, and that the old way is the media moguls of Hollywood and record labels and government and that those powers are bad and the new things are good, and that it's the job on the angel side is to support these things. But, you know, it's a very narrow way of thinking, and it's just what we've learned because of how networks are concentrating power and wealth is that it's just replacing one kind of elite with a different elite, and that it doesn't really get us to a better place. It's not as different as it seems. And also, you know, for young people especially, to be trapped in this old melodrama that was invented among a circle of people 30 years ago just seems so narrow. And if nothing else, even if every idea I'm presenting is wrong or turns out to be even worse or something, which is always, you know, I'm an empiricist, so we don't know until we try things. But whatever else I hope to accomplish, I just want to try to open up the way people think a little bit. I think young people these days are living within an incredibly narrow focus, that they think that the ideas as given in the current generation of online systems are the ultimate, and they can't imagine alternatives, and they sort of have a bit of a fanatical quality sometimes, which I think is very negative. And so even if somebody just absolutely disagrees with me totally, I hope that at least by thinking about it, they'll find that they're looking at the world a little more freshly than they had before.
What about some of the other specific ideas that you've had? Pricing structures, for instance.
Well, my thought is that a healthy market is one in which people set their own price and price is allowed to evolve. And that's not the kind of market we have right now. Right now, we have algorithms that just price things in this very monotonous way to centralize power and money and undercut everybody else. And like the Amazon price bot is watching everybody else in the world and will set an Amazon price to zero if need be, just to undercut somebody. And in a sense, they're willing to, in the near term, cut off their nose to spite their face, because in the longer term, information supremacy will win, and they have it. And that, to my mind, isn't real capitalism. The better thing would be for people everywhere to have the freedom to set the price of information that exists because they exist. And that would be a complicated constant thing since you're being measured constantly by algorithms. So you'd probably work with some service or counselor or something. You know, you'd find some way to get some help with it. But, you know, then the price would evolve. And so you could, what I think would happen is that people would start pricing information in such a way as to preserve a bit of liberty so that you're not being constantly tracked all the time for other people's benefit, but not priced so high that you're not benefiting. Like there'd be this balance that I think would create a sustainable middle class in a democracy. And you know, precisely why I think that balance would be found is a little theoretical and admittedly needs to be tested. And I would hope to sort of in the next decade or two find ways to test it in small scale before trying to subject the world to it. But I actually think it would work because I think it's just following on market effects that we've already seen before the internet and then just a better internet design.
You know, at the end of your book, you recommend that we actually try taking breaks from all of the online, the free online services we use for a few months. You've done that yourself, right?
Yeah, absolutely. What I advocate is not becoming, let's say, I don't know how to put this, to try to avoid fanaticism or, you know, extremism. So I don't want people to say, oh, the online world is terrible and it always ruins your cognition or makes you inauthentic. I don't think any of that's true. But I do think you should experiment with yourself and just cut yourself off for a period of time just to see what it's like, see what resources you have that don't rely on the online world, see who sticks with you as a friend, even if you're not on a social network with them. You know, just experiment, just see. And I think you might find, if you do an experiment like that, that you've learned a lot about yourself and what the internet means to you that you couldn't possibly learn without testing it.
Well, what did you learn?
Well, you know, I learned a couple things. One is I find that when I connect with certain online designs, it brings out this frenetic kind of weird, insecure, competitive aspect of my personality. Like, for a little while, I was blogging on the Huffington Post, and I was really successful at it. I was always right at the top of the front page. But I found that when I was doing that, it brought out this kind of weird, grasping demon from inside me that was always seeking attention, and I couldn't let go, and you're constantly having to stay on top of it. You can't even let a day go by because, you know, you'll lose a little bit of momentum. And I just felt that my own thinking was losing a bit of depth, and that I was just working on a dimension that was shallower than where I wanted to be. So I just cut it off cold turkey. And I felt that writing books and doing the other things I do sort of allows me to think a little deeper and a little bit more courageously, because I'm not quite thinking so much about feeding the beast of popularity constantly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so, like, I think you have to kind of just see how it affects you. And just because that's true for me doesn't mean it's true for someone else. I mean, I believe strongly in cognitive diversity, and I'm sure there's some people for whom that experience would be just the right thing for them. So there's no judgment here of what works for someone else at all. In fact, I celebrate people who are able to find success in these designs that are out there today, and I don't you know, oppose that in any way at all. But I think what we should try to do is not assume that every design is good for everyone, but we should experiment and be willing to say, even if there's sort of this incredible social pressure to be on Facebook or something, if it's not good for you, you don't have to be. And I've personally found I'm not on Facebook or Twitter or any of these things, and I still seem to be able to have best-selling books. I mean, I think this notion that we're all sort of trapped between constantly self-promoting ourselves or just falling into total obscurity is false, that, you know, that people will find their way to your stuff if it's got some value and you can kind of relax about it a bit. And I just found that by experimenting with not being on the things.
Well, as someone who has so far successfully resisted joining Twitter and who is not on Facebook nearly as often as people tell me I should be, thank you.
You know what it reminds me of a lot? When I was born in 1960, and in the 1970s and early 80s, there was unbelievably intense social pressure to use drugs, and I just had this feeling it wasn't the right thing for me. It wasn't a matter of judgment about anybody else. It wasn't any negative assessment of anything. It just was this feeling it wasn't right for me, and to resist the social pressure was incredibly hard. Similarly, there were some things about sexual behavior like that and all kinds of other stuff. And to me, like, internet use is like that these days. There's this incredible social stigma if you don't make the same choices that everybody else is making. And that's just got to end. It's just a really dumb way to run a civilization.
Yeah, I know. Though none of us have actually managed to escape high school yet. Thank you. Thanks so much for talking today.
Oh, certainly.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right.